Hey guys, real quick, two things. I want to first thank our sponsor for the week, Diversey Fund. We'll tell you more about them during the break. And second, stay to the end because Sam and I are going to be telling you the new details of our new Patreon that we're launching and all the perks that we're going to be giving to the first 50 members, as well as for you guys who show support to the show.
Welcome to the Invest Like a Boss podcast.
I'm Sam Marks.
And I'm Johnny FD. We're self-made entrepreneurs who invest our own money and use modern technology to invest like a boss.
Join us each week for exclusive interviews with our network of modern investors, business owners, and multimillionaires to discover new ways to invest our hard-earned cash.
Hey guys, it's Johnny, and welcome to episode 134 of the Invest Like a Boss podcast. I'm sitting here in Chiang Mai with Sam Marks. Welcome to the show, buddy.
Welcome to the show, and welcome to the roaring 2020s, everybody. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, everyone. Wherever you are in the world, I hope you're having as good of a time as we are.
And I hope that you brought in the New Year better than I did with food poisoning fresh from Laos.
Yeah. You know, I think that just sounds like people who haven't been allowed, they're like, oh, that sounds like a place you would get food poisoning.
I'm two for two. I've been there twice, got food poisoning. Came back, actually, both times to Chiang Mai with food poisoning.
I've only been in Laos once, and I ate nothing but chicken baguettes, but I didn't get food poisoning.
That's how I got food poisoning, chicken baguette.
Oh, they're so good.
The first time. The second time, it was something weird, like latte and a croissant or something. I don't know.
Oh, man.
Anyways, I heard the fireworks going off. What did you do for New Year's, Johnny? Did you have any celebration?
Yeah, so I just went to a friend's house here in Chiang Mai. I've noticed a growing trend with more and more long-term expat nomad friends renting or even buying houses long-term and living just slightly outside of the center and having like a three-bedroom house with an office and having kids and, you know, we're just preparing for it.
So Johnny and I, Johnny actually hosted what's called a six-figure sushi last night, where he invites people from locally, but happens to be in Chiang Mai this time, to have sushi, and it's all high-income earners. We just talk about life and investing and things like this. And everyone there was actually doing what Johnny said, living outside of Chiang Mai in a house. Most of them starting families. Johnny and I were the only two that were living actually in Niemen area. It's interesting.
Yeah, it's crazy because most of these guys I actually met 5 or 6 years ago. And it's funny because we were all broke at the time. All of us were bootstrapping. All of us were living off of $1,000 a month. And all of us just kept, you know, just kept at it. Just kept pushing our online businesses. And it's awesome to see how successful people are.
Yeah.
One of the guys just sold his business for, he wouldn't tell us exactly how much it was because I think he's pretty modest, but it was multiple seven figures. So more than $2 million.
Did he buy sushi?
You know, he was the one that ordered the seven figure sashimi plate that looked insane. I think it was like all of our sushi was like, you know, $15 a plate or something. I think his was like $50 for that place, yeah. The sashimi.
And that's the great thing about Chiang Mai too, is it's so unassuming and you meet everyone at that table and everyone was doing really, really well for themselves and extremely unassuming group. You know, you couldn't tell if everyone was flat broke or multimillionaires, which was the case for most of them.
Yeah. And that's what I like about Chiang Mai, that it's evolving and growing. It kind of sucks that a lot of the really like new nomads are heading to Bali now because they hear all this stuff online about the burning season starting or, you know, the visas getting harder. But as a new nomad, you have a fresh passport. You can come to Chiang Mai as much as you want for the first couple of years before they say anything.
Yeah.
And burning season, it's January. It's fine. Like, you know, it's starting earlier and earlier every year. But until it actually like gets bad, just enjoy Chiang Mai because there are really cool people here right now. As, you know, like we witnessed last night with the six-figure sushi.
Indeed. Indeed. Yeah. Well, guys, Johnny, I'm looking forward to our New Year's updates. This will be specifically investment-oriented. So we did a previous episode a couple of weeks ago that just talked about 2019 year in review. And the reason we did that episode is because our quarterly reviews have been getting longer and longer with a lot of life, travel, and everything else baked into the investments and personal finance. So we decided this year was such a big year. Let's narrow that out. So if you guys want to hear about what we were up to on the personal side of things, including all of our travel and locations of 2019, check out our last episode. This episode, we will dedicate fully to investments, what we've been up to personal finance-wise in 2019, and what our big plans are for 2020.
And I'm really excited for once because I've actually made a lot of big moves. I sold a lot of stuff, you know, getting ready to buy a lot of stuff. So I think for the last probably couple of years, it's been, you know, pretty steady saying, you know, I'm holding, I'm not buying many things, I'm not selling anything. But this quarter was a big move quarter for me. And what about you, Sam?
I would say this has been it's been a great quarter because I've seen movement while I've been head down either in work or taking time off in Siberia. And for some of the longtime listeners, go back maybe a year and a half ago, and there's a lot of episodes where, like, you know, everything just seems to be going sideways and I can't figure out the math behind it because I've got enough invested here, but I don't see any compounding. And people in Boss Lounge pointed out, hey, it's just because you've only been doing this for a year and a half. There's not enough time for it to actually start compounding. But now we've been in this, you know, since we've been doing the podcast, we're actually entering our fifth year. And just by basically doing nothing, by reinvesting the dividends and the stock market going a bit more or less sideways, really started to see numbers start to move this year. And then also with the increase in the market towards the end of this quarter, really start seeing some accounts pop, which is a great feeling, because at some points you feel like you're just going to go sideways forever. And sometimes you just need time.
I felt exactly the same way. I was actually really stressed this year. I was worried this year because this was my lowest earning year since I started online business, you know, since 2013, probably. And I almost had to kick myself out of the six-figure sushi club because on paper, I didn't make $100,000 this year. I made like 50 grand, which is basically...
It's not even close.
I know. It's like half. It's basically like the salary of like a... Like, I don't know. Is like I a manager
tell you,
at
No, I can
Burger
tell you
King?
Exactly what the salary is. It's like the salary of when you left the USA and were working a security job back in California.
Yeah. So... I was stressed thinking, man, like, this is embarrassing. And I can't host six-figure sushi if I'm not making six figures. But then I was doing my year-end kind of updates, and I realized that my net worth, I guess to spoil it for everyone, has grown by 80 grand this year. And that's not including the money I spent. You know, and I spent a lot of the money this year traveling around. So I made well over 100 grand this year, at least in growth. And most of that, or at least half of that, is through the investments compounding and growing. So we're going to dive into all of that. And it's exciting. I think it's finally at that point now after 5 or 6 years mm-hmm. where it almost doesn't matter how much active income I'm bringing in as long as I'm fully invested and that money's making money.
Yeah. And I think just if you break it down, I started looking at compounding interest calculators last night and models. And I think for most, if you're a typical kind of $5,000 a year saver, if you can save $400 a month, I think that's in the wheelhouse for most of our listeners. You can save $5,000 a year. To get to $1 million, you really need 30 to 40 years compounding. And that's why a lot of people see their accounts seem to go sideways, because when you take in the volatility of markets, you could have a 10-year period where you feel like you haven't got any type of gains in it, right? But fortunately, this year, we have had gains in the market. It's been lifting up. And if you just take, say, a 3% dividend reinvestment, which you can get almost with the S&P 500, over the course of 5 years, as we've been basically investing in Vanguard, even if the market goes sideways and that money's reinvested, you start to see a pop. Luckily, we got a lift this year, and then we saw a really significant increase. So,
yeah, and you know, even with really high earners, like the guys around the table last night, the hot topic was what to do with your money and investing. And a lot of those guys are just holding onto cash because stocks are expensive right now, real estate's expensive right now. But what they don't realize is if you hold it, you know, in a 0% interest fund or savings account, you're losing 2 to 3% every year just on inflation. Mm-hmm. So you're guaranteed to lose money. But then even if you put it in the stock market and it just stays neutral, you know, goes down, goes back up and just ends up the same, people forget you're making that 3% dividend that is automatically reinvested. So either way, you're better off being invested than just sitting on the sideline.
Speaking of 3% dividend, did you check your December Vanguard?
Yes, it was very nice.
Is it good?
Yeah, I think I had, let me pull it up right now.
So while Johnny's pulling up his, we mentioned this in the Boss Lounge, but every year, and I believe this is true across most stocks, investment accounts that are holding equities and or bonds, is December seems to be the biggest month for dividend and distribution. Obviously, it makes sense. it's the end of the year. Stock companies have seen how well they're doing and are making a distribution. But usually, at least in Vanguard, the December month is usually 2 times bigger than any other month of the year for distributions. So if you haven't yet, log into your Vanguard account or your equities account and don't look at the movement in December, but actually look at what the dividends or distributions were, the fixed income or earnings for that month. And you should see a really good pop, which is a really nice feeling.
Yeah. So if you guys just kind of sort by a table and you can see the monthly balances, under market gain loss, that's the movement going up and down. That's your paper gains. And sometimes that's red when it goes down. Sometimes it's green when it goes up. January happened to be a good month and went up by a lot. But if you look at the next column, the income returns, that is always green. You know, it might be zero, but it's always green because that's the dividends. Mm-hmm. And for kind of earlier in the year, it would range, you know, be like $900, $800 per quarter. This was the first check where I got close to $2,000. It was $1,787 in pure just dividends, say Christmas gifts.
Yeah. So if anyone's looking at their stuff on a monthly basis, I encourage you to look at the earnings side in the distributions, because that's always going to be green. If you look at the actual net gain or net loss of your account, that can give you some type, all types of emotional triggers, because it's not going to be up every single month. But if you look at the earnings, that's the addictive part, because as you continue to contribute more and more into your account, those numbers are always going to be going up and up. And that gives you that psychological benefit to keep on that track.
Yeah, definitely. So that's a really, really exciting. Did you do anything else with your index funds this quarter? Did you sell anything? Did you buy any more?
No, I've kept it all the same. Now, all of my Vanguard and all my Wealthfront is set to reinvest automatically outside of a couple of the bond funds. And what I do with those is when I get cash from those, I decide where I want to reinvest it. So it's almost like it's a manual reinvestment. But usually what I do is I'll pick the index fund that is the loser of that quarter and I'll reinvest into that. So it's kind of a manual rebalancing, if you will.
So this is the first time I've ever taken money out of my Vanguard. It's always grown. Every month I've been putting money in, you know, the same amount. I think I put $3,000 in every month for the last 5 years. And that has now grown to about $250,000 just in Vanguard. Mm-hmm. And it's been my biggest fund. I'm, you know, most excited about it. But after listening to that Ace Chapman episode and talking to him, and I actually hung out with him here in Chiang Mai, he came to visit, I realized, you know what? I want to buy a business. I want to get back into business. I think it's kind of a big investment play where there's a potential for big ROIs, and it's non-correlated to the stock market, real estate market. So I needed to free up cash. I needed about $100,000 in liquid cash that's going to sit in like a markets account just to earn, you know, 1.7% interest for now. But I had to, you know, clear it out. So you're gonna hear throughout this episode everything that I've been selling, and I've also taken this as an opportunity to have less accounts total, because I think it's been really, really fun these last couple of years interviewing all these different opportunities and hearing, you know, basically being excited and putting $15,000, $20,000, $30,000 into each of them, and it's been good because it's been diversifying us, you know, just in case, you know, things would go down or things would go bad. But it's honestly been a pain in the butt, not only for my accountant at the end of the year, having, you know, 20 different, 1099 forms or tax forms, but also for me just to even log in every month to check my balances. You know, I don't want to have to log in 20 different accounts. My goal is to have, you know, 8 accounts, maybe 10 max, and just say that's what I invest in.
You know what account I was able to close this last quarter and also in 2019, fortunately?
Lending Club?
Lending Club is gonzo.
Oh, I'm so excited for you.
One less form to file, one less account to log into. I literally had like $7 in the account left in bonds, and I couldn't close the account because you still had money in there. There's no way to liquidate it. So I was just hoping that would get freed up by the end of the year so I could close in. It just happened last week. So I closed the account before the 31st. I'm like, yes,
one good job.
Yeah, it feels good.
Yeah, one of our first investments, but also, you know, a good lesson learned.
Sure.
Of unsecured peer-to-peer lending just isn't a good business model. Yeah. You know, that's why I'm so excited about Pure Street, mm-hmm. which is a secured version of peer-to-peer lending. So same concept, you get interest every month, but instead of having your loan be backed by nothing, it's backed by real estate, which they can sell if that person doesn't pay. And someone actually asked in the boss lounge when I posted my screenshot of my Peer Street dashboard. I had like 161 or 200, you know, active loans, 161 like paid off loans, and then one that was default. And of course, people were, you know, not looking at the 161 like good ones. They're like, what happened to that one bad one? You know, like what happened? They're freaking out about it. And I looked into it, and you know, it's complicated. They have to repossess the house. They have to, you know, give them, you know, all these chances to pay off the loan. So it's a long process. It's a drawn out process. And then you have to take the house and evict the people in there. And then you have to try to sell it. And I'm glad that I'm not the one on the phone trying to do that, or even having to talk to someone else to do it. They have their team where they take care of all of it. Mm-hmm. And I think at the end of the day, I lost $50. So basically it was a break even.
Right.
So I got my money back. And meanwhile, the other 161 loans are making money. So in my opinion, it's like well done. Like, and you know, sometimes people aren't going to pay things off. And if the economy, the real estate market takes a hit, there's going to be more of those defaults. Mm-hmm. So it's important to have good loan to value ratio, just so you know the house is going to, you know, be relatively worth the same, even kind of like in a quick sale, in a short sale. But also, you know, just kind of be prepared. Like the economy goes down, there's going to be more of these defaults, but just, you know, be happy that you're not the one needing to go evict people.
Yeah, agree. So Johnny, where should we continue? Do you want to go down your list of investments? What's new? How things performed? Or should we start somewhere else?
Yeah, we can definitely do that. So how about this? I'll just go down and then we'll just go one for one. So first, cash accounts. For me personally, I went from having too much cash the last couple of years and not having everything, you know, in the market, to finally needing to clear things up. So my cash went from, you know, 30 grand to almost 100 grand now, just to sit and hope for a deal. If I do buy a deal, I will let you guys know next update, or maybe in the boss lounge, or something we'll talk about a little bit later. Sam and I are going to start a Patreon, mm-hmm. where we're going to give you guys the up to date kind of like literally, I'm going to, like, if I make a trade, if I sell something, I buy something, I'll post it in there first. Mm-hmm. So you guys don't have to wait until the next quarter to hear about what we did. But the goal is for me to have that cash ready. So as soon as, you know, I see a deal I like, I can just jump in and buy it. So all that money is basically in Marcus, which is earning 1.7%. Which dropped from 2.2, but you know, it's still pretty good.
Still decent, but it's not 2.2. Well, when we got to 2.2, everyone was like, man, getting all types of free coffees and lunches on Marcus every single month.
Yeah.
We still are.
So for you, are you using Marcus or Ally?
I'm using Marcus.
Okay.
I've nothing but good things to say about Marcus since I've started it. My dad actually tried to set up a Marcus account and couldn't because of some Patriot Act. He keeps getting blocked and we can't figure out why. And the bank won't tell him. I'm thinking it's because it's like his name's my name and it looks like I'm trying to set up a second account or something.
No.
But I, similar to you, for different reasons, have been freeing up cash. And actually, that was funny because we were actually doing the exact same thing this quarter, but not in any type of collaboration. It just happened that you're freeing up cash to buy a business and I'm freeing up cash to buy a condo in Barcelona. So all last quarter, I was not actually investing in a lot of new things. I was actually taking money off the table. And the way I was doing it was using cash that was distributed from some of my productive assets, such as the REITs in Singapore, Hong Kong storage, taking some of the money that's coming due from Peer Street off the top, Yield Street, some of the municipal bond distributions. So I've been taking that and putting it into Marcus, and then from Marcus sending it to my new bank in Spain, getting ready for the real estate transaction there, which should close at the end of January.
So end of this month.
End of this month, yeah.
Wow.
So I have to go over there and get it all done. And there's always a debate whether rent versus buy and if buying's a good investment. In this case, it probably doesn't make sense because Barcelona is such a good renter's market. Like you can rent a million euro condo for 2,000 euros a month. similar some places in the world, like, you know, Shenzhen used to be, you could rent like a $3 million place for like $1,000 a month or something. But Barcelona is a great renter's market. But unfortunately, there's no way for me to actually rent there because to get a visa to stay there long term is really challenging. So getting the golden visa for me was the obvious reason. But I started looking at it as an investment as well. And I think it's actually, it's not a bad financial decision because if you say, okay, if it's going to cost me 2,000 euros a month to rent a place, let's say that's 25,000 euros a year, right? Or let's say $30,000 a year, right? How much money do you need to make $30,000 a year? And how much money do you need invested to make $30,000 or $1,000 a year passively, Johnny?
300 grand, at least.
At least, right? And that would be being pretty aggressive, yeah. Like with APH servicing or something, yeah, like that. So I would say if you're making a conservative 5%, you would need 600,000, right? So if you had 600,000 invested and you made 30,000, then you could pay for your rent. But you also have to take tax out of that 600,000, right? So you have to have maybe more like 800,000 to make that. So if you put that 800,000 into an apartment, okay, you're not making any, but you're not paying tax on any and you're getting free rent. So if you look at it like that, it's basically a wash, right?
Yeah. And there's a chance it might appreciate.
I mean, a chance. And then you're in a productive asset again. So
I don't know what the property taxes there are, the maintenance costs, but
almost zero, which is great. So the thing that sucks in Spain is when you buy a place, you have to pay a 10% transfer tax. But once you own it, let's say it's $1 million place, your monthly taxes are something like $150. So like it's compared to the US, and that's where people get in trouble in the US is like you inherit a property or you buy a property, you don't realize, okay, if it's $1 million property, you might have to pay 20 grand a year just in taxes plus insurance plus HOA. Things like this can all of a sudden balloon and get really expensive. So before you buy a property, make sure you check out what all the taxes are and the just passive carrying cost are for that property. In Spain, fortunately, it's low, but you have to pay that tax to get in, which is inconvenient.
I probably wouldn't have bought the property myself in my situation, but I can see why you did it. And I'm happy I have a free place to stay whenever I go to Barcelona.
You're going to be set up for free all around the world pretty much.
Yeah.
Except you don't need it in Chiang Mai. You're only paying $250 a month here.
$250. So. And I guess quick update with that, without getting too much into it, I'm very happy living here. Mm-hmm. I'm actually the happiest I've been in Chiang Mai for years, and this is by far the cheapest and crappiest apartment, but it's because I'm in the best location. Like, even just being two or three blocks away, it wasn't the same as just being able to walk downstairs and having like 20 restaurants and having the gym and the five coffee shops like right there. Like, I feel like I'm in like the heart of the city for the first time ever.
Do you mind the 6 a.m. new 6 a.m. flights out of Chiang Mai flying over your head?
You know what's funny is I actually don't notice the airplanes, mm-hmm, at all. I think the only time I notice them is if I have my windows open and I'm watching TV, and for those like 10 seconds, I can't hear what they're saying. But aside from that, like at night when I sleep or in the morning, I don't notice it at all. Right now with the podcast, we had to close both windows, and luckily they designed it pretty well. They have like a glass sliding door, a little balcony with another sliding door, so you can't hear the planes, but it forces us to use the air conditioning just so it doesn't get stuffy. Mm-hmm. So hopefully that doesn't pick up. But no, it's great. I'm very, very happy here, and I like the fact that I'm living cheaply again in Chiang Mai, even though I actually don't really need to, just because I know this is an option if I ever need to go back to this lifestyle.
Yeah. Let's touch on that again later in the episode, because there's some good points on that and things I've thought about this quarter as well that I've also observed.
Okay. But let's get back to the money. Mm-hmm. All right. So next we have Pure Street. For me, I actually put in another 10 grand at the beginning of the quarter, November, before I knew I was going to buy a business. So this is kind of a weird quarter for me because right in the beginning, like November 1st, I put a bunch of money in new investments or added to my positions. But then in December, I decided, oh no, you know, I actually want to free up some money to sell some stuff, to be able to buy the business. So I added 10K to Pure Street, really because I really would like to see my Pure Street account have 100K in there. Right now it has 88K, and it's nice, you know, making 7 to 8% interest for everything. It's hands off, it's passive, you know, it's a great company. I just like them. What about you?
Likewise, the only issue I had with Pure Street this quarter was that I have it on automated investing, and my money's not going out at the same clip as it used to. So right now I looked at my account, 10% of it is sitting in cash, and that used to never happen. I just think they keep getting flooded with more and more demand. So I think in order to get the money out the same clip, you're going to have to reduce your limitations or widen your parameters per se on your automated investing. Or I need to try some of these other, like I'm only using that one loan type, which is, I think, the bridge loans, which is like their standard old, long-term, whatever their original type of loan going out, through like the platform.
The 12-month, 24-month loans. Okay.
Yeah. So, and then they've introduced these other types of loans. I think they're like
1 month, 3 month, 5 months.
Like, yeah, exactly. But I haven't heard anything about that. I'm not educated on those. So I haven't tried them yet. But I reached out in the Boss Lounge and it seemed like a few people have done them with at least relative success, including yourself. So maybe I need to dive into those.
Yeah. I mean, they're fine if you need your money to be relatively liquid and just, like, I'd rather just get 3% interest than have it sit there for a month.
Yeah.
Because what I did, I also widened my parameters. So I used to ask for 8% interest. Now I'm like, I'll be happy with, you know, 7. Mm-hmm. You know, I used to want a only 12-month term so I can have my money liquid. And then I bought a couple that were 24 months. I'm like, you know what? Like, I'm probably not going to need that money in the next 2 years anyways. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that I'm hesitant to adjust the LTV, the loan-to-value ratio, because I want to have at least 25, if not 30%, you know, like basically money in that property, like that equity in that property. So they're not taking out a loan on the whole 80% of the property value. They're only taking a loan on 65% of the property value. Mm-hmm. And that way, you'll be sure that if we do hit a recession and these places have to sell, that you probably won't lose much money.
Yeah. And I would just point out another great thing that I love about Pier Street is how the money's always coming due. So if you layer these at 12 months or even put some in at 24 months, conceptually, each month, if you have enough loans, each month, some money's coming due. And I use that to, in part, finance the Barcelona house. I waited for 2 or 3 months for cash to pile up. And then I put that into a bank to do this, to part finance this Barcelona condo. And then the new cash that's piling up, I've turned it back onto auto investing so that it can be redistributed into more loans.
So one thing that you can do is set your auto parameters at what you want, but then once a week or once every few weeks, log in and just manually invest in things that, you know, you're like, ah, that's fine, whatever.
Yeah. And then I think we didn't touch on this actually because it was right before or right after our last quarterly update. But we did our summit out there the day after our quarterly update. And about the week after that, they announced that they've raised $60 million Series C or Series D, I forget, funding. So I'm sure there's big things coming from Pier Street. They're already a good company and looks like they'll be expanding really quickly from here as well.
Yeah, definitely. So shout out to the guys at Pier Street. It was super fun meeting you guys and hanging out at the Invest Like a Boss Summit last year. Stay tuned for a 2020 event. No idea where it's going to be, if we're going to have one, but I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, right. So next one, how about we talk about Wealthfront real quick? Because this is one of the accounts that I've been warm on since we got started. It seemed to start well, then it seemed to go sideways. And it seemed like they were changing up some of their funds without any type of consent. And it looked like some of the funds were branded Wealthfront. And it was just a little bit confusing at times. But this year, I looked and it was up 20%. So the account was up 20%. That's also partially because at the end of 2018, we were in a bit of a pullback. But the previous peak for the Wealthfront account, and I guess probably also relates to the general market, was December 2017, January 2018. So really 2 years ago. And that's why if you go back and listen to a lot of the episodes in between that period, we'll always be talking about the market kind of went sideways type of thing. Wealthfront just seems to kind of go sideways. But now it's at its all times high, and a 20% rise over the end of last year was great to see all that green in that account dashboard.
I don't know if I saw a 20% rise, but it definitely went up. And the reason why I'm not sure exactly how much it went up is I actually turned on auto deposits a few months ago. And I did it for a very small amount, literally $100 a month, because I figured I wouldn't notice that leaving my bank account, mm-hmm. but it would just kind of slowly trickle in and grow. You know, my big deposits I put into Vanguard and other places. But I was like, you know what? Let me just put this on, because if I put in $100 a month in this for the rest of my life, and first off, I will never notice it leaving my bank account, mm-hmm. or at least in theory, and then it'll just grow a bit faster. And so far, so good. I literally forgot that I had money coming out of my bank account until just right now. But it grew from 55,000 to 59,000 in the last quarter. So yeah, it's definitely growing.
55 to 59.
Yeah.
So that should be 10%.
Yeah.
But in the last quarter.
The last quarter.
Okay, I looked at it over the last year. Okay. I didn't look at it over the last quarter. I know it's up a lot. Most of the gains have been in the last quarter. But maybe it was 5% in the beginning three quarters of the year. And then, yeah, because at the end of last year, we were in a pullback. So,
well, at end of last year, it was at 30 grand. Now it's at 55 grand.
So I think you had even bigger gains.
I probably had bigger gains, but I also probably put in bigger deposits.
Bigger deposits. And I think your risk tolerance is maybe like two points on 10 higher than mine. I think mine's like 6 or 7.
So. Mine's like 9 out of 10.
Anyways, so that's been good. And that's all been automated. They're using tax loss harvesting. So that account was pretty solid last year. One thing that I have that you don't have, an investment in Hong Kong. I'll just point this one out because it was really interesting what happened in Hong Kong, and sad and interesting and all like different types of emotions, especially for people from Hong Kong or that visit Hong Kong a lot. It was a rough year and especially a rough quarter in Hong Kong. Still some turmoil going on there. Hopefully they'll find a solution. But when we were in Siberia, you know, I was with three guys from Hong Kong and everyone's got different views on it. It depends a lot of the walks of life you're with and if you're in business or politics or whatever. But, you know, everyone had the same emotions. And Kevin, who I do business with there, you know, he had an event a couple of years ago that made him say, hey, I want to get out of property for the most part. I want to move into passive investing. I want to live a little bit more of, I want to have more of a lifestyle, versus just like staying in Hong Kong and worrying about my property empire. So he started liquidating a lot of properties, and then putting it into passive investments. And then when we were in Siberia together, you know, all this chaos is going on in Hong Kong, and I've never seen the guy so stress-free. You know, imagine he had not liquidated those properties and all the stuff's going on. So we're in Siberia and the few remaining properties that he has left, including a couple of ours, the property price has gone down 20-25%, but self-storage occupancy is at all-time highs, right? Because of all the chaos, everyone's downsizing, put stuff in self-storage and leaving. So as long as you're not forced to sell the properties, business is a booming. It's unfortunate that, you know, a lot of people are going through hard times and business is going good. So we're not flaunting it, just saying like self-storage is an extremely, extremely robust business that I've not seen anything put downward pressure on it. Good economy, bad economy, geopolitical events, turmoil, recessions, whatever. Self-storage seems to continue to grow, especially through down cycles. The only thing that puts negative pressure on it is oversupply and too much competition. But it was encouraging and inspiring to see Kevin during such a period of when most people that are doing business in Hong Kong, living in Hong Kong, are extremely stressed out and worried. And we were just in Siberia, like whatever, like things are great.
That's the beauty of passive income, mm-hmm. and diversification as well. Is you could just chill out and be like, all right, let me sit this one on the sideline. You know, let's hope it works out. But if it doesn't, I'm just gonna hang out here on the beach in Thailand.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and not worry about who's throwing rocks and bricks through my windows and things like this. So
you know, or even, you know, buy a campfire in Siberia in the snow.
Let it snow.
So speaking of real estate and kind of, I do have a couple of funds. I'm invested in Fundrise and Realty Mogul. Are you as well?
Not Realty Mogul, but Fundrise, yes.
Yeah. And, you know, those continue to do well. I like them because it's my dream to own some apartment buildings, but I don't want to manage them and I don't want to put up the whole 20 million because I don't have that. But I do like having fractional ownership and having other people take care of it. So Fundrise is doing good. For the quarter, it's up about 5 grand. So it went from 63 to 68 grand.
That's net asset value.
Yeah. The NAV, and that includes, you know, their projected equity, but also kind of in the cash that was reinvested from the monthly the payments.
One thing that we always forget about Fundrise, which is pretty cool, is you can there's a liquidity clause. Basically, you can redeem your shares. You can sell your shares and liquidate. And I always think of Fundrise, I'm like, oh, I'm locked in for 5 to 7 years. But you forget, you can basically get your money out. I think it's a 60-day waiting period. So you put in your request and 60 days later, you sell it out. And I think as long as you've held the shares for more than like 3 years, you can sell it at the NAV. If you've held it for less than 3 years, I think you have to sell it like 1 or 2% less than the NAV. But That's a great tool that they include in there. And if you look at your NAV, I think both of our NAVs are up pretty significantly from where we've invested. So, I mean, that's real money right there.
And it's so passive.
Yeah.
You know, one of the guys at Six Figure Sushi last night, he was talking about, you know, buying property in South America. And he's like, yeah, see, you know, value going up there. And but then he said, you know, but I'm so worried about having to deal with it or even have to deal with the property manager there. Like, he's like, I don't want to ever have to fly there and stress about it. You know, he had a bad experience with his property in Canada before he moved to Thailand. And he's like, I don't want someone calling me like with issues, you know?
Right.
And he's like, I worked too hard, made all this money. Like I want to make more money with it, but I don't want that stress. So I said to him, I was like, hey, man, like look for a real estate fund in South America. If you want to have exposure there and you don't mind giving up 1%, you know, have someone else manage it, like it's worth it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you compare some of the different funds that we're in from REITs to Fundrise to private property funds, you have REITs, which will have the maximum volatility, like any given day, those things can be up or down, but it's also maximum liquidity. Like you can sell it in a second. Then you have Fundrise is sort of like in the middle where you can liquidate it in maybe 60 days. There's very little volatility, which is great. If you look at the NAV over the course of 5 years, it kind of just goes in this short linear direction up. And then the private property funds, which have very little liquidity, even less volatility, I suppose, and probably arguably the best gains. I would say you probably have the best gains, but you have the least liquidity. You're locked in for kind of 4 to 7 or even longer term. So just some different types of property funds and passive instruments that you guys can look at that we talk about a lot on the show.
Yeah. And then you have Sam's Barcelona apartment has zero liquidity because they will revoke his golden visa if he ever sells it.
But it's got a chandelier, Johnny.
Oh,
so, like you know, you got to have a place to put your wine, buddy. aside from the golden visa, like we all know there's ways that at least someone with a North American passport and of course European passport and a lot of Asian passports can stay in Europe year round. You can easily spend 3 months in Barcelona and then go to Andorra, which is a 2-hour drive away and spend 3 months or Croatia or Ukraine or Ireland, right? There's different ways you can do it, but I've really enjoyed the experience of having the place here in Chiang Mai and knowing that I have a closet here, I have bags here, clothes here, I know all the people in the building. And when I get off that plane, I feel like I'm at home. And I wanted to recreate that feeling in Europe, which is where I want to spend, at least plan to spend the rest of my 30s and part of my 40s and possibly raise a family. And I wanted to get that process started as early as possible. And that's really what drove the decision.
Yeah. And, you know, Barcelona is a nice place. I think the only complaint people have is the price of property there or rent there, but if that's sorted, then you don't have the headache. Barcelona has really, really well connected airport, you know, has, you know, decent weather year round. So,
you know, when the Spanish went to California first, they called California New Espanol.
Okay.
So they thought like California was Spain. If you go to Southern California and you go to Barcelona, same climate, same attributes. You have beach, mountains, vineyards, all within an hour drive. I mean, it's really the same thing. It's just a third the price and, in my opinion, a third the stress.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, it's a good place. And actually, funny enough, is when you drive around California, all the street names are in Spanish. People forget that.
Good point.
I'm on La Cienega, driving down, you know.
Hey, bosses. This week's sponsor is Diversifund, an alternative investment platform providing the same investment opportunities as the wealthy. Their goal is to help close the wealth gap and enable all Americans to achieve financial freedom by opening up the world of alternative investments
and let you invest and build wealth like the 1%. Their current investing offering is the DF Growth REIT, a portfolio of commercial real estate focusing on value-add and multifamily apartment buildings. What makes Diversity Fund different is that they are vertically integrated, which means that they own and operate all the assets. That allows them to remove the middlemen, not charge any platform or asset management fees. Best of all, they're invested alongside with you, so you know their interests are aligned with yours. Even then, they pay their investors before they pay themselves. Go to diversityfund.com to learn more or get started for as low as $500. Use promo code BOSS20 to get a $20 Amazon gift card after making your first investment. That's diversyfund.com.
Yeah, but let's talk about a couple of things that we exited out of to clear up cash for the Barcelona apartment, but also for the business buying. For me, I completely cleared out all my cryptocurrency.
Wow.
I decided, you know what? It was a gamble. You know, I put 5% of my net worth in it during that mad bull rush a couple years ago when everyone was hyped about it. And I was so afraid that these Bitcoin billionaires are going to start driving Lamborghinis and I was going to be left out. So I lost money on that. Mm-hmm. And I was going to just keep it in there and just say, oh, maybe it'll go back. But the thing is, unlike, you know, US stocks or even like, you know, real estate, there's no guarantees it's going to go back up. There's not even really a reason for it to go back up. You know, the US stocks, like if you bought, you know, 100 shares of Vanguard VTI total US stock market index fund, unless the US completely just, you know, goes to zero, which we would have other problems anyways, it's eventually going to go back up. But with cryptocurrency, there is literally no reason for it to ever go back up. It could, but there's no guarantee. There's no reason. And I decided, you know what? I'm just going to cut my losses, not think about this. So basically, I sold everything. I think the only thing that I sold all my Bitcoin. The only thing I have a little bit of left is a couple of shares of Ether just because it's so low right now. And I'm like, you know what? I'll keep the $3,000 in there for a few more months, and if that goes to zero, then, you know, I lost $3,000. But if it goes up, then, you know, hopefully I can make some of that up.
Wow. So Johnny's no more in the crypto scene.
Yeah.
I think that's actually, yeah, I think for where you're at, it makes sense. It's always just kind of like this little annoyance sort of in a way. I did the same with RMB. I mentioned this partly on the last quarterly update, and I cleared out much more of it on this one. It was the same thing. Like I had way too much money sitting in RMB. And it's been going down ever since I bought it, or ever since I exchanged it to RMB 4 or 5 years ago. It's been going down, and I keep thinking it's going to go back up. But I just don't like the fact that someone wakes up in China every single day and decides what they want to set the currency to against the dollar. And we saw it this last quarter, like they just kept devaluing it. And then all the Hong Kong stuff. So I said, it's time just to get fully out of that. It's not like I'm ever going to go live in China and spend RMB or make investments in RMB. So it's literally just a currency hedge, so the dollar. I figure get out of that. I take a loss, unfortunately, but it's a learning lesson. And I'm putting that money now into the Barcelona apartment, which is also a currency hedge against the dollar because it's a euro-based investment. And the euro's at a relatively decade-long weakness right now to the dollar. It's like 1.10 to the dollar. Maybe it goes to parity with the dollar, but I think it's probably more realistic it appreciates from here. So I think it's a good time to make an investment in euro, and especially decent time to get out of RMB.
Yeah, that's probably a smart move. I would never trust any money in RMB anyways.
Yeah,
or anything in China.
I've heard they're like I heard this through Thai TV that pretty soon they're going to RMB is going to be the official currency of Hong Kong and Hong Kong dollars out. Oh, I haven't fact checked that with anyone anywhere else, but we saw that on Thai TV first. So
I don't know. But speaking of hedging dollars, I did this accidentally. I had about $2,000 of Thai baht sitting in my Bangkok bank account. Mm-hmm. And I kind of just forgot about it because I was like, oh, I'll be back next year. I'll just spend that money when I get here. And I logged in and I was like, wait, why do I have so much more money in here now? I think I had like, you know, 2,500 or something. And I realized the baht got stronger, the dollar dropped against it. And without even realizing, I had hedged myself against Thai, you know, inflation or the baht getting stronger. Mm-hmm. So this trip, I'm just withdrawing money out of that Bangkok bank ATM and I'm spending money like, you know, like the, like I'm getting basically a 10% discount on everything.
Okay. Yeah. You know, everyone, we talked about this last night, but the bot is strong right now, and everyone here is blaming tourism, like the lack of tourism. I mean, I see tourism everywhere, so I don't see the lack of it, but everyone's blaming the lack of tourism on the bot appreciating like 10%. And I'm like, I don't see what the difference is. Like, pad thai is still a dollar. Like, whether bot's 30 to the dollar or 34 to the dollar, pad thai's still a buck. So
yeah, but some other things start adding up, like, you know, like the dollar versus dollar 10 moves, you know, aren't that big of a deal. But like every, I don't know, it's just like little things. Like it, things aren't as good of a value anymore. Like, you know, I went to watch a movie last weekend, and the movie ticket was $8 US. And I was like, you know what? I don't remember it being that expensive, because I remember going, you know, every week just because it was so cheap compared to the US. But now you can watch a movie in the US for like, let's say $12 or $15 or whatever it is. So it's like, it is still almost half the price, but it's not like what I remember, you know, the movies being like free here. Like it used to be like $3 or something. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh yeah, I'll go every week.
Times be a change. And there's also a lot of other places that were never on people's radar before that people want to travel to, like, you know, Georgia, Ukraine, like other places of really good value that no one would have traveled to 10 years ago. But now they're like, well, maybe instead of going to Thailand, I'll go check that out.
Yeah. So the lesson learned from this is, I think places that I plan to go back to every year, I might leave, you know, a little bit of money in those bank accounts, mm-hmm. just as a hedge for spending. So like, for example, especially if you can make interest off of it. For example, when I go back to Ukraine, I might open a local bank account and put $3,000 in or $5,000 in, especially if I can earn, you know, 18% interest on the Ukrainian hryvnia. Mm-hmm. But if nothing else, just so the next year when I go, I can spend that money there again.
Yeah, makes sense. So you had crypto as a loser this quarter officially. I had RMB as a loser this quarter officially. Did you have any other losers?
No, I think that's it. I think, I mean, maybe a loser could be having the money just sitting in cash, because it might take 3 months or 6 months to buy a deal, or maybe I might never buy a business. Mm-hmm. So the time out of the market might be time, you know, money lost, because as far as I've seen, the, you know, index funds keep going up.
Right.
And I'm just sitting out of the market.
Yeah, that is, we've had some episodes on that as well, right? The only market timing is total time in market.
Yeah,
I agree. And Johnny's out.
I agree. So anything else that we missed?
On the investment, well, do you have your actual portfolio where you ended up in terms of allocation?
The percentage-wise? Mm-hmm. I don't think so, but I'm sure I can make a little graph real quick.
Yeah, let's post that in Boss Lounge later, see how you ended up on the year. I'll just give a review of where I'm at. So pretty comparable to the end of 2018. The biggest move for me was actually into cash just to get ready for this Barcelona purchase. But where I'm at now, where I ended the year, my biggest allocation is stocks and equity funds. So this would be like my Vanguard and Wealthfront accounts combined. That is 20% of my overall portfolio. Annuities is now 15%. I just added one more annuity to it at a 3.6% interest rate, fixed rate for 5 years. I know it sounds crazy to people, but there's a lot of extra benefits to these annuities. They're creditor protected. They're tax deferred, so they can grow basically until you start taking money out tax-free or tax deferred rather, which has a big magnifying effect on the growth. Then I'm at 18% for physical property, 15% for property funds and REITs. It'd be like Fundrise, my MapleTree stuff, things like that. 6% for municipal bonds. Those have all been great this quarter. I'm pretty flat, but they yield 5%. There's always cash coming free from those, and it's all tax-free cash. So I really like those. And then private investments would be like my angel startups and my own private companies. That's just under 10% at 9%. Cash at 4%, or actually total cash at 11%, foreign cash of that is 7%. And then all of my alternative investments like peer-to-peer lending, Yield Street, things like this, gold stocks and cryptocurrencies all comes in at 4%. That's 100%.
I like it, buddy. So I actually just did the pie chart real quick while you were talking. In cash, I have about 20% now, just because I'm sitting on the cash. In my Vanguard account, it's about 35%. So if I add that with my Wealthfront, it's close to 40% of my investments is in index funds. And then I have about 10%, in real estate funds. So Fundrise and Realty Mogul combined. And then I have 5% in notes with PPR notes and AHP fund. Mm-hmm. Those are two investments that I always forget to talk about because they're so boring. Basically, I just set them up and they just deposit money in my account every month. Yeah. And the same amount. It's always one of them pays 10%, one other pays 13. So I either get, you know, I get one deposit for $125, another deposit for $200. And it never changes. The account value stays the same. It's, you know, 20 grand every time I log in or 15 grand every time I log in. And the deposit is the same. But actually, those are probably some of my best investments.
It's true. So true. We always forget about them because on a 1 to 100 scale of passive, they're basically 100. And the difference in that versus like Fundrise being 100% passive is Fundrise sends out regular updates about what properties they're acquiring, what's performing well, what to expect in the next year. So while it's completely passive, it's still somewhat intriguing and engaging. Whereas these note servicing funds that Johnny mentioned that both of us are in, there's nothing. There's no, this is what's happening. This is what we're going after next year. Like it's all just behind the scenes stuff.
Yeah. But those are some of the best investments. So take a listen to those episodes. AHP fund as well as PPR notes. I'm still very, very happy with them. Mm-hmm. One investment that I'm very sad has finished. You know, most of our investments are 3-year, 5-year terms. And there's one that we made right in the beginning that I'm so sad to see gone.
And you know, we both have this that I missed?
We both had it. Well, actually, you know, you couldn't get in.
Oh, interesting. I don't know.
It was the pre-litigation settlement funds with Yield
right.
Street.
Right.
That was paying out 13% like clockwork for the last 3 years or 5 years, whatever it was. And they sent me a check saying, here's all your money back. It's done. We're finished. Like it's at the end of the cycle.
13% clockwork, man.
Oh my God. It was so good.
Think how dreamy that sounds in hindsight.
I know.
That didn't seem real.
I wish I would have put more money in there.
And these were like hedge funds and big institutions have had access to for decades and that people like you and I could never figure out how to do it unless we were super hands on and actively managing something. But to make 13% passively has always been something that's been restricted for the big boys and insiders. So it's great that you were able to get a piece of that and hopefully we'll find more deals like that in the future.
Yeah. So View Street, you guys are listening. What's up, man?
Yo.
What's up, guys?
Throw us a bone.
I know.
Giving you guys all this love. Get Johnny and I some insider access to these deals.
Like make enough deals for everyone because I thought that it was just like a temporary thing. We're like, it was going to take a while for them to package some more deals together. Might take 6 months, but it's been a few years. Like, are there just not that many pre-litigation settlement like deals out there to go around, or is just some big institutional investor just, you know, picking them up as they come through? Like, what's the deal?
I don't know. I mean, there could be a part of that too that we've seen the same trend in all these platforms. They start out super hot, amazing offers, and over time yields start to go down a little bit. It can be said for everything from Yield Street to Pier Street to Fundrise. I mean, Fundrise, my yields used to be like 9%. Now they're sitting at like 5%. So I still like them. I'm just sitting there like, why? Like, why? I mean, if I really dug into the numbers and did a big analysis of it, I probably could figure it out. But it has to have something to do with a mixture of fees, over demand, I don't know, but the fees have to be part of that, right? Like they start out hot, they get lots of user demand, and then they slowly dial it back.
I mean, that could definitely be part of it, where in the beginning they just want to attract more clients. Mm-hmm. So they just pay as much as they can, take as little out of it as they can. But we also have to remember that money has become very cheap in the last couple of years. So maybe everything is exactly the same. It's just that interest rates keep lowering.
Yeah.
So money's cheaper. There's more money out there.
They don't need money from the crowd.
Yeah. So, I mean, like that could be very, very well it. I mean, I don't think – because Pier Street is always taking 1%. Mm-hmm. It's just that they used to be able to charge people, you know, 13% for a loan. Now they can't. Now they can only charge them, you know, 10% or 9%.
Well, also, there's more demand now, too. So I think, yeah, it's both sides. Before, you had to offer out 9% to get people to jump into this new platform and take a chance, whereas now everyone's believes in it. They're credible. Now they can say, oh, we'll do it for 5%.
Yeah.
You know?
But I don't know. I mean, honestly, I think it has more to do with money being cheap, because I think if – for just Pure Shred as an example, I think if the house flippers and the rehabbers were willing to pay 14%, Pure Shred would happily just take the 14%,
mm-hmm.
And take the 1% cut, because that actually would be more of that. You know, it would be – I guess they wouldn't get – necessarily get paid more, but
no, so
people would be
actually,
happier.
You're right. So Pure Street is just taking that 1%, but it's the people on the other side that are making the off. They're putting the offer out. That instead of them putting it out at 11%, they're putting it out at 8% because they know they can get money from the bank cheap.
Exactly.
So that must be how it works.
Exactly.
But I mean, if conceptually, if you and I, Johnny, were sitting down to start one of these platform, these marketplaces, that would be our business model, right? We'll be like, look, we're going to come out with 100 offers. They're going to be amazing. We're going to get tons of people in. And then, like, over time, like, the, you know, we can offer a less lucrative deal because we're out of the demand. Like, that just makes sense from a business side of things.
Yeah, I definitely agree.
But I agree. I don't think that's the model for most of them. I think most of them are taking a flat cut per deal. So it must be from the sponsors that are making that happen.
Yeah. But I mean, either way, I'm happy that we are pretty well diversified, and that we have our money, you know, in a good mix of like real estate funds, mm-hmm. notes, index funds, and then, you know, a smaller percentage in things like, well, formerly cryptocurrencies, but things, you know, that are a bit more high risk, high reward, like out of FX, the cryptocurrencies, things that we were, you know, from day one, we've always told everyone, don't put more than 5% of your money in, just because you never know what's going to happen. It can be the biggest returns, but also can be the most volatile. So remember, guys, you know, diversify, use your own better judgment, do your own due diligence, because Sam and I, we're just investing our own money. You know, we're learning along with you guys. I think now both of us have had quite a bit of experience talking to a lot of experts over the last couple of years. But, you know, when there's a next big turn of the market, who knows, man? Like, all of our investments are going to go up and down.
Yeah, and that's why diversification is key. It sounds boring as a concept, but if you go back and listen to the Meb Faber episode and the Paul Merriman episode, we talk a lot about diversification. And basically, you get the same level of returns as if you went into, say, just the S&P 500 over a historical period. But you take out all the volatility, which when you take out the volatility, you take out the emotion. When you take out the emotion, you take out most of the mistakes that you're going to make. One mistake over the course of 10, 20, 30, 40 year of investing can just destroy your entire plan. So you got to eliminate the mistakes. You got to eliminate the emotion. Johnny, a couple things before we wrap up. Let's talk about some of the questions that we received in the Boss Lounge, and then let's make sure we touch on some of our goals for 2020 before we end the show.
Sure. What are the questions on the Boss Lounge?
So a couple people, which continues to come up whenever we post like our portfolio, is people want to know how we're planning for a recession. Have you given any thought to that? Is there anything that you're doing in your own investments or own life planning to plan against a potentially coming recession?
So for the last 3 years, I've been planning against a recession and keeping too much cash. And then that's ruined, like that's, you know, hurt us. So for me personally, I keep 6 months of expenses relatively liquid in cash. I live as cheaply as possible. And that way, instead of having, you know, needing, you know, 60 grand in cash, I could just need, you know, 10 grand in cash. I'm happy. I like to be pretty diversified through, you know, not like, and that's the reason why I don't have 100% of my money in Vanguard, even though I love Vanguard, is I don't want to have all my money in one thing. So that's why we have the show. That's why we invest in different things. And then also just like having extra money come in from other sources, like knowing that, you know, as long as I'm making money through other means to, you know, either passive income or active income working, then, you know, who cares if there's a recession? Like, mm-hmm. I'll just lay low for a few years, not spend much. No one else will be spending much anyways.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can live in this $250 a month apartment for the rest of my life in Chiang Mai, and I'll be happy. And yeah. I think a lot of people can't do that because they have too much overhead.
That's right. I agree.
What about you?
Yeah, I was reading an article the other day. I was trying to figure out how much the S&P has grown historically since 2000. Because over the course of history, everyone knows it's basically grown at 8%, right? Well, since 2020, I haven't checked it through the end of year 2019, but I checked it through the end of year 2018. Guess how much the S&P 500 grew on an annual basis?
8% on average?
3.4.
That's it?
Yeah. So their point was, everyone's been talking about this is the longest bull market in history, and a recession's got to come any day. But their point is, at 3.4% growth, the bull market can continue forever, for the rest of history, you know? And so everyone wants to plan for a recession. I don't plan anything in my portfolio around a recession. What I do is more what you've been talking about, lifestyle planning. So every time I track my expenses every single month, when my expenses get too high, I immediately take that next month and say, I'm going to dial things way back. And then a couple times a year, I go into the real extremities where I'll just come and live off, you know, a couple $1,000 a month instead of 10.
And real extremities of Sam, of a millionaire.
Right. But that's, but I think for most of people listening to this podcast, living off $2,000 is extreme, right?
Yeah,
like,
that's true.
And people don't have complete control over it. Like, if you're in a Western country and you have a house, a mortgage, cars, kids in private schools, things like this, like, or you're divorced and you have alimony, things like this, you can't necessarily control your fixed costs. But that to me would be the, like, if we get in a recession, I know if I had to, I can go live really, really cheap, and I can wait it out if I have to. And I think that's where people should do a lot of their recession planning, is try to figure out how to eliminate some of the heavy fixed cost. A good example is, I just did it in the US. I had $4,500 a month in fixed costs between car insurance, apartment, memberships, things like this. I basically got rid of all that down to 1,000, right? Small example, but it, like, if you can do those things, if you can eliminate some of the big fixed costs, you put yourself in a much better shape to get through a recession. And then you don't necessarily have to plan your investment portfolio and take money off the table.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And if any of you think your situation is different or it's not possible, I encourage you to take a look at this new documentary called Playing with Fire. Mm-hmm. We posted it in the Boss Lounge. Unfortunately, there's also a new Hollywood movie with the same title, making it very hard to search for.
Yeah.
And they're not on Netflix or anything. So whoever their marketing guys are there, you guys need to step it up. Change the title, get it on Netflix. You know, it's a good documentary, but it's called Playing with Fire. You know, the FIRE community is financial independence, retire early, but it's really just an example of a couple with a young kid who was looking to downsize. You know, they were spending a lot of money living in San Diego, nice, fancy condo. You know, she was driving a new, you know, BMW. He had a nice luxury car too. And their fixed costs were high. And they decided, like, you know, how low can we get our fixed costs while still enjoying life and not sacrificing the things that matter to us most? So I do think that every single person, no matter what you think your specific situation is or why it's different, there is a way to bring your fixed costs down a bit lower.
Yeah. And I would just add to that, if you're worried about recession, think about your primary stream of income. Think about the company you're working for. How robust are they to get through a recession? Because if you have high fixed costs and then all of a sudden you're out of a job in a recession, then you're in really bad shape. And on the other side of that, if you have a business, whether it's a small business, one or two person operation, or something larger, start thinking about how to plan ahead for that. How do you eliminate some of your fixed costs? How do you weather a recession? And that may well be offer offer stock options to your employees, but be able to reduce their salary compensation. That puts you in a better shape to get through a recession. And also, like, if you own a business, I mean, think about your employees, because you want to be able to build your business robust enough, not only for yourself, because you got a lot invested in it, but your employees that have worked hard for your company. You want to make sure that your company can survive a recession and not lay people off at a really difficult point in everyone's life.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. I love that. Were there any other questions?
That's it. I get a question quite a bit about the Barcelona place, if I'm going to be renting it out while I'm not there on Airbnb. And the answer right now is probably not. I just think that'll be my home, so I don't want to necessarily rent out my home. Goal is to be able to stay there most of the year and find – that's one of my big goals for 2020. Find the same quality of life in one place as you can in being in 30 places all year. I think it's a super big challenge for anyone that's been on the road as long as we have and traveled as extensively, is just getting to one place and settling and being cool. So that's a big goal for 2020, but we'll see. I mean, Barcelona's got a really hot Airbnb market. But
I would 1,000,000% suggest renting out while you're not there, because I think you're going to end up spending less time there than you think you're going to be. And think of it as a benefit, is every time you leave, you can have your team go in, clean the place, you know, and then, you know, rent it out. You get some passive income coming in. And then just before you show up again, have them go back and clean the place, you know, and then, you know, you'll have your place to stay whenever you want. What I would recommend, though, is first, don't buy anything too precious where you're gonna worry about other people touching your stuff. I mean, obviously, you could have like a separate duvet and a separate set of sheets that it's yours only, and just instruct your Airbnb manager, like, this is, you know, only for me. Put this on like when I'm coming back, but then use the guest sheets when they're there. And then have one closet that you can lock where you can keep your personal stuff, like things that like you don't want anyone using or touching. But have everything else, like the TV, the couch. Like, who the fuck cares, man? Like,
yeah.
Let them sit on your couch.
No, normally, I would agree with you. This place was built. It was built in 1919. It only had one person live in it. So the person was born in it. Basically, a lady moved in, had a kid, like, the next day. That kid lived in this place for 100 years. She grew up in it, lived in it, died in it. It was 2019 when she passed away. She lived in it 100 years. The place hasn't been touched in 100 years. No renovations, nothing. So all the floor is original. All the ceiling, the crown molding, there's murals on the ceiling. It's just like all classically. So it has to be renovated, but it's all going to be very, it's not some place I want to rent, you know? It's because, and then also if I do that, like you said, I have to make a decision on do I furnish it cheap or do I furnish it like a house that I want to, you know, potentially raise a family in one day. So I think the decision is don't plan on doing it. If I end up spending 3 months a year there, then maybe rent it out, right?
And I think if you don't plan for it, you'll never rent it out.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I mean, the other option is just charge a premium for it, you know, and, you know, don't try to maximize your days of, yeah. So I would advise, like, don't look for maximum occupancy rate. If anything, just charge a premium. And that way you're only getting very premium renters, which are normally kind of better renters anyways. Mm-hmm. Cause I think by having so many condos sit empty, you're really missing out.
Yeah. Like, it's a good point. I actually just started renting out, my Thai apartments again.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah. And it's been a good experience. But what I found, and I don't know if this is coincidental because I haven't done it enough. When I was doing Airbnb short term, like 2, 4, 5 nights, I was having a lot of problems. Like 3 out of 4 people I had an issue with. Like they came in, they complained that the water smelled and I go smell the water and the water doesn't smell. Or they complain that there's noise on the roof and like there's never noise at the sea. I mean, so, I don't know if that's a coincidence, but the short night stuff, there was a lot of problems. So I stopped it. Since then, I've gotten people that have come in and rent for 1 to 3 months. No problems. All been great. So maybe that's more the strategy. You get someone that gets in, gets settled versus thinking it's a hotel room and everything's got to be absolute mint. That's it.
Definitely. So even if you set it so it's monthly rentals only or minimum 3 weeks or whatever it is. Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, we should do another episode with some people that do more Airbnb stuff because it's always such a hot topic and it's something I still want to learn more about.
Yeah, and there's so many opportunities out there to just go in and just dominate markets.
Yeah.
Kiev, Ukraine, somebody please go there, rent a bunch of apartments long term or buy some places, renovate them a little bit, put in a flat screen TV. You can charge $1,000 a month easily because I'm looking at that range between $800 to $1,000 a month. And I'm looking at places that have those old 27-inch CRT TVs from like your grandma's day. And I'm like, dude, just put in a flat screen and charge $100 more a month. You'll make your money back in 3 months and more people will rent it.
Do you remember when we went to Odessa and we were looking on Airbnb and it was like, are you kidding me? Like this is – it looks like these old – I don't even know how to describe them. It was,
like you're somewhere where your grandma lived.
Yeah.
And then left.
And yeah. And like – and so uncomfortable, so static and just the worst furnishings. And I'm like, this can't be it. But let me ask you, why not if you think the opportunity is so good in Kiev for something like that, why not take the $100,000 that you put aside instead of doing a business, get in a place there and rent it? And use it yourself when you want.
I'm actually looking into it.
Yeah.
That's something I'm looking into when I'm there.
Okay.
Yeah.
I know the Hong Kong guys are interested in doing something like that too. So if you, maybe we can all meet over there and look at the opportunities together.
Let's do it, guys.
That would actually be fun. Wow. I think we just
Kevin
came up with
Shea,
something good.
Let's do it. Let's go look at some real estate. We'll have some fun. Have some good food too.
Johnny, any revelations over the last quarter? Any new thoughts about life? Any good things or bad things?
Oh, so many.
Yeah.
So many.
It's great. Give me a couple of the top ones.
I mean, like, honestly, just the fact that I can live cheaply again in Chiang Mai it's made me realize, you know, lifestyle creep is real.
Mm-hmm.
I've only stayed in nicer and nicer places since I started making money. And I thought I could never be happy in a studio apartment again, but I actually am happier. And what I would recommend is everyone hustle your butt off when you're in your 20s and early 30s, make as much money as you can, save up as much as you can, invest all of it, and then just take it easy in your mid 30s and your 40s, have more time for the simple things. I think that's the play. I think we both accidentally stumbled upon this, but I think that's the play, is make a lot of money, have the investments, have the passive income, and then chill the F out and just say, all right, I'm gonna live cheaply and just enjoy life now.
Cause then you know, and then you can enjoy it. Whereas the poor farmer in India is always looking at like TV of Hollywood thinking,
yeah,
poor me.
Yeah.
So maybe that is it. Cause you know, they always say that the guys in Bhutan or the people in Bhutan are the happiest people in the world. I've been to Bhutan. They're not happy. Half of them are alcoholics. And it's I think they used to be happy in their way of life, but now they got the internet and TVs and they're looking at everything like, wow, my way of life is super backwards and we've been missing out and mistold and withheld information, and look at all these other places that what they're doing. And by that comparison, I think they're no longer happy and they're turning into drinking and things. But to your point, if you've lived that life and you've achieved that, and then you can go back and decide to live that as a comparison, then probably much better state of mind. Well said, Johnny.
Especially if you have some money in your bank,
mm-hmm,
as a backup. Especially that way.
Yeah.
So hopefully everyone crushes it in 2020, wherever you guys are at, both, you know, geographically, wherever you guys are living, but also just where you guys are in your journey of investing, whether you're just starting out or if you're, you know, you've exited for millions or if you saved a lot of money and you're just trying to diversify. It's fun hanging out here with you in person again, Sam. I really miss Chiang Mai. I'm glad I spent a few months here this year. The goal is to spend some more time here next year as well. Look forward to hanging out in Europe.
Yeah, I think we'll try to get together in Georgia as well. I'm going to try to make that trip happen.
Yeah, summer in Georgia. That's going to be really fun. I'm going to be there May, so mm-hmm, hopefully you can be out there as well. If any of you guys are listening want to come out, we can do a meetup out there. And we touched on it very briefly earlier, but Sam and I are getting busier. And one of the things that has been suffering, if you've noticed, is having less episodes. And I know a lot of people have written in asking for 3-4 episodes a week like we used to do, but we don't have time for it. And I think the only solution is, well, first, you know, we were like, okay, we'll just cut down. We'll just do like, you know, one a month or something.
Mm-hmm.
But Sam came up with a great solution. He said, why don't we just hire someone? Let's hire someone to do the interview scheduling, the outreach, you know, basically all the stuff takes a lot of time. You know, Sam and I will still do the interviews, and the quarterly updates as, you know, as we've always done. But if we can have the money to pay for a full-time, you know, either VA or staff member to basically schedule, you know, find all the guests that we want, you know, Sam can give them a list of the guests we want and they can go out and just do all that, the scheduling and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, obviously that's going to cost some money. And we think the fairest way to do it is we're going to start a Patreon. So if you guys haven't heard of Patreon, it's a cool concept where basically you can subscribe for, you know, $5 a month, $10 a month, whatever you want to give, and you'll get a lot of member only perks. So the first thing that's going to happen is if we can get, you know, let's say, you know, 100 people at $10 a month, we can afford to hire a full-time VA or staff member. We can afford to do 3-4 episodes a week still, like always. But then as a thank you, what we're going to do is we're going to add you to a special Patreon-only group where instead of you guys having to wait for the quarterly updates to see what we're buying, what we're selling, we're going to post things right away. And we're going to share, you know, screenshots of our dashboards so you can see the exact dollar amounts of what we're buying, what we're selling. And that way it's going to be, you know, I mean, honestly, like I'm a pretty transparent guy, but sometimes I'm like, all right, do I want to show this trade that I'm thinking about making right now and have it go out to thousands of people? Because mm-hmm, if they all make that same trade, maybe it messes up my position. But if it's a small group of 100 people, I'm happy to just post it that second, you know, and that way you guys don't have to wait a whole quarter to see like, oh, Johnny, you know, bought more Facebook stock or Johnny sold this stock or whatever it is, you know, and same with Sam. You know, I think same with Sam, like, you know, he's always been very transparent with his like allocations once, you know, once a quarter, but I think it'd be cool. I would like, even me, I would personally love to see some screenshots of his dashboards, for like how much he actually puts in, you know, Vanguard, for example. And Sam's agreed to put that in the Patreon only lounge. So if you guys want to sign up for it, we're going to have a link on investlikeaboss.com. We're going to put a link on the top. It's either going to say Patreon or something like that. And then we'll have it in the show notes of this episode as well. We'll put it in the Boss Lounge as well. But I think the tiers, I think they're going to be, let's say, you know, if you just do $5 a month, well, thank you. Mm-hmm. And if we get enough people, you know, if we get 200 people at $5 a month, we can start having 3 or 4 shows again. But as a perk, the next level would be at $10 a month. If you guys want to do that, then we'll put you in this private group where you can have, you know, access to the screenshots and all that. Mm-hmm. And if we can get, you know, even if we get 50 people, you know, we definitely want 100, but if we can get 50 people at $10 a month, we'll even do a quarterly Patreon only Q&A. So we do a live Q&A just for you guys who support the show, because we know that you guys are serious. You guys are bosses. And a lot of you have written in saying, well, thank you guys so much, because the tools and the tips that we've learned from your show has helped me invest my money safely, help me diversify, help me get started, or help me make a lot of money. So that's the goal, is to have all of us continue to, you know, raise the tide so all the ships can rise. And we want you to be part of it. And obviously, if you're a baller and you want to give a bit more, we're going to have some other bonuses for that. So I'm excited.
I'm excited too. And just to echo what Johnny said, we think this is the best and the most fair way to do it. We have a decent amount of people that want to sponsor the show that we just don't feel are adequate to bring onto the show and put, you know, put on iLab and to, you know, have Johnny record a sponsorship ad, putting our names behind it. And we don't ever want to turn the podcast into a business like that. We don't want to bring on guests that we don't think are going to be excellent guests. We have maybe 100 guests that write us each month, to come on the show. Typically, we don't take any of them. Most of the scheduling and the guests that we bring on is 100% outreach by us, but that just takes a lot of time and we need help to be able to do that, because the guests that we're going after are higher and higher tier. And it's all just to bring more and more value to you guys. And so we can just continue learning on this podcast, 135 episodes in. So 2016, 2017, 2018, 2019, now in the books for iLab. And now we're entering the 2020s. Johnny, thanks. Thanks for being a great co-host. And thanks to all the listeners out there. I've certainly learned a lot. I know that what I've taken out of the podcast has helped me tremendously, and just understanding, and putting, you know, managing my own money, and just giving me a lot more confidence just about the future in a lot of ways of life. So thank you to everybody. And I hope, the 2020 is an incredible decade. And this is an incredible start to the decade for everybody.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And thank you, Sam, so much for being, you know, part of the show. It wouldn't be here without you. So we really appreciate you, and I appreciate all the listeners, especially the ones who've taken the time to leave reviews on the iTunes store. I know it's clunky. I know it's hard to go in and leave a review, but it helps us so much, because it's the way that people find us when they haven't heard about us. You know, if they're searching investing or how to invest in the podcast store, Invest Like a Boss comes up because you guys are leaving 5-star reviews. So if you have, thank you so much. If you haven't, please take a minute to do that. That'll be the best 2020 gift or late Christmas gift you can give us. I want to give a shout out to Stanley North. Says, love these guys. 5 stars. This podcast is turning into my secret leg up on understanding alternative investment opportunities from people centered within the top industry. Also, Jeffrey says, quality points, 5 stars, great info for the best life, next steps. There's a ton of them that just came in this last month, including some for 2020. So I'm really excited about that. So thank you guys. And again, if you want to support the show, if you want to start hearing more episodes again, if you guys like the show, you're getting a lot of value out of it, go to investlikeaboss.com. Click on Patreon, sign up to our Patreon. We're going to give a little special bonus to the first 50 people who sign up. So jump on in right now, and it's going to be excited. So if you've been listening to the show for a while, you've gotten value from it, go in, put $5 in, put $10 in, because it's going to help us produce the show more regularly again, you know, because, you know, this is content that has helped a lot of people, and hopefully it's helped you. So show some support, investlikeaboss.com. By the way, big thanks to our sponsor for the week, Diversity Fund. Check them out and invest like the 1%.
Thanks for listening to the Invest Like a Boss podcast. Join our mailing list at investlikeaboss.com to get exclusive access to our insider investment portfolios and our private members forum.
If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Tell your friends and leave us a review in the iTunes store. It helps more than you know. See you guys next week.